to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the integrative cancer care charity, helping people to address cancer in a truly holistic way. My guest on the show this week is Dr. Jay Harness from the USA. Dr. Harness has taken on the challenge of getting exercise into mainstream oncology. As a breast surgeon, he's well versed in the challenges that bringing change to oncology can present, but he's determined to make his mission into a reality. Hi Jay, delighted to have you as my guest on the Yes to Life show.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Robin. Thank you very much.
Great. So today we're going to be speaking about the crucial role of exercise in cancer care, something I understand you're deeply passionate about. But I realize that although you've had a lifetime involved in cancer care, most of that has been at the forefront of breast surgery, improving the treatment of breast cancer. So I wonder if you'd start out by telling us how you came to be a surgeon and about your life in healthcare.
Well, I'd be privileged to do that. Thanks very much for asking. So I'm born and raised in the state of Michigan in the United States. And after my pre-med work, I ended up going to the University of Michigan School of Medicine, got my MD degree there, and then I remained at the University of Michigan for my general surgery training with a major focus on surgical oncology. Then I was privileged, Robin, to stay on the faculty at the University of Michigan for 14 years. And in the middle 1980s, we created one of the U.S.'s very first academic multidisciplinary breast centers. By that, I mean at the breast cancer center that we set up, we had the surgeons, we had the medical oncologists, we had the radiation oncologists, and the nurses and everybody we needed. Plus, when we were done seeing the new patients in the morning, we would immediately adjourn to a tumor board where we discussed as a group what was the right path forward for these patients. Just as a point of history, in the early 1980s, where the results of some of the very first clinical trials, both in the United States and Italy, that demonstrated that you could do breast conservation and not have to do a mastectomy on everybody. And in layman's terms, that was called a lumpectomy, typically followed by radiation therapy and lymph node removal, et cetera. And so it was really critical, if you will, then to have a team collaborating, not only seeing the new patients, rotating around, but then ongoing involvement in their care, long-term follow-up, et cetera. I was subsequently then recruited to Boston, was there a few years in the Tufts University system, and then ended up moving to California into the University of California healthcare system in the early 1990s. And up until just a few years ago, was a resident of California, having a career that involved both academic surgery as well as private practice surgery. The backstory about how I got involved with exercise for cancer patients is about, I think, almost eight years ago. Somebody introduced me to some folks involved with this, and I was really thunderstruck that I did not know about the science behind all of this. As physicians, we all know that exercise is good for us, but what I was not aware of was at that point, the 30 years worth of clinical trials that had been performed that clearly, overwhelmingly demonstrated the importance and value of exercise starting right at the time of diagnosis, let alone in prevention, through the active treatment of a cancer, whether it's breast or any other cancer, and particularly on into long-term survivorship.
Yeah.
And I was really thunderstruck. Why, as somebody specializing, did I not know about this? And what I quickly figured out was this phenomenal first-class research had been performed by outstanding PhD researchers in exercise physiology, kinesiology, even sports medicine. And from 1990 through last year, there have been roughly 3,000 clinical trials, resulting in around 30,000 publications about the importance of improving the outcomes for cancer patients with what we call moderate intensity exercise. And the reason I didn't know about it was because virtually all of these publications had been in the PhD literature with very little crossing over into the general medical, let alone the oncology literature. Mm. Anyway, that's my long story, and there you are.
Right, okay. And we didn't actually say why you got into it in the first place. People have usually got a bit of a backstory about why they took up medicine in the first place.
Sure, I'd be happy to share that. I come from a family of patent attorneys.
Okay.
My grandfather founded the family law firm with two other partners in Detroit, Michigan, at the height of the growth of the automobile industry in 1921. My father and his two brothers then became patent attorneys, and I was the eldest of the next generation. And since I had grown up out in the countryside outside Detroit, and we had horses and other animals, I spent a lot of time with the veterinarians. And I knew I didn't want to do veterinary medicine, but I was convinced I wanted to do real human medicine. In my generation, I was the eldest. My late sister ended up being a PhD family therapist. And of my female cousins, two ended up being registered nurses and one a social worker. So in our generation that followed, none of us ended up in the law, but we had a big emphasis on healthcare, okay?
Yeah, big generational switch, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing that you were involved in quite a few other cutting-edge developments in breast cancer care over the years that you were a surgeon. Is that right?
That is true, sir. I think the beginning of that was with the development of the Multidisciplinary Breast Center in the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. I remember when I presented my very first manuscript at a regional surgical meeting about the model we had created at the University of Michigan. I thought I was going to be booed off the podium because the surgeons in the audience were all irate. No, this is a surgical disease. We don't need all these other people involved in this team business. What is this harness? But you know what happened? I was there for the whole meeting, and quietly over the next couple of days, people came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Jay, have you got a minute?" "Sure." "You know, that thing you were talking about, that multidisciplinary, that sounds really interesting. You know, we kind of think maybe you're right. Could we come visit you at the University of Michigan and learn more?" I said, "Absolutely." And, you know, Robin, it made so much sense to us that this was going to be the future. And at the University of Michigan, the overall head of the medical center cornered me just before we started the open the center. And he almost pinned me against the wall.
Yeah.
And he said, "Harness, make this thing work."
All right.
Oh, I put my hands up and said, "Well, yes, sir. What is going on here?"
Mm.
"Well, We think this might be the future of all cancer care.
Wow.
And if you can make it work, we're going to eventually build a building around the whole model, but you make it work." Well, I was recruited out of the University of Michigan in the late 80s. I can tell you today, the Rogel Center, which is the cancer center at the University of Michigan, has 18 multidisciplinary clinics.
Wow. Wow.
So it's clearly the model, and it wasn't just for breast cancer, Robin.
No,
prostate, it's for
everything.
Pancreatic, it's for all of them.
Yeah.
It really
well,
is.
I mean, from where we stand now, looking back, it's kind of like, well, how did they ever manage without it? You know, it's kind of like it's got common sense written all over it. And that there should be any resistance is, well, remarkable. But yeah, there was obviously some very forward thinking people there who picked it up and got to run with it. So that's excellent.
there is an inherent natural resistance in healthcare. And too often we're in too many silos. We're not talking to each other. We've got to break those barriers down. I think that may be an issue for you all there in the UK.
I think it is. Yeah. Okay. And after that, you went on and did some other quite cutting edge stuff, didn't you?
Well, yes, sir. So I got involved early on in the 1990s when I actually moved to California. One of my colleagues came to me one day and said, "You know, Jay, you're primarily focused on surgical oncology. I'm a vascular surgeon. Our colleague here, Steve, is a trauma surgeon. We're realizing the increasing role of ultrasound, not only already for vascular surgeons, but the trauma surgeons are using it to quickly examine the abdomen in trauma cases. And we think there would be a major role for this in breast cancer to help augment your physical exam and potentially guide procedures. So we'd like you to learn how to do ultrasound." And I said, "Okay, sounds good." And they said, "Oh, by the way, we're teaching in 3 months a course on ultrasound, and you're going to be one of the lecturers."
Right.
I almost fell over at that point and quickly got involved, learned the rudiments of how ultrasound images are made, how to run the machine, etc. When we put on that regional course for one of the regional surgical societies, and one of my colleagues from the University of California came up to me and said, "Oh, Jay, that was a wonderful lecture. You're so knowledgeable in the field." And I'm rolling my eyes. And then we were demonstrating on models, and we had people do live demonstrations. And this colleague turned to me and said, well, tell me, how many procedures have you done?" And I said, "You know, I haven't done my first 100 quite yet." It's that old, you know, sometimes, Robin, you just have to fake it till you make it. Okay.
You do. That's the only way to go.
Anyway, that is now a standard of care for all breast surgeons, okay? That then led to our doing our own core biopsies to speed the diagnostic process up. I've been very involved in the world of what's called oncoplastic surgery, is one of the early adopters of that. Meaning onco, meaning cancer, plastic surgery, meaning that when we do our lumpectomies and the other things we do to the breast, we want our patients to look better than they did historically. So we combine in that procedure plastic surgery techniques and often bring a plastic surgeon into the operating room to work with us as well. Some of the leading oncoplastic courses are actually there in the UK, and the UK breast surgeons are quite adept at this. So that was it. And then probably my last major contribution was in the area of what's called nipple-sparing mastectomies, where we hide the scars in the fold underneath the breast and up in the axilla. We can literally deliver the entire breast out through those small incisions, obviously being very aware that the margins are clear. And my last textbook was on nipple-sparing mastectomies. And that's now become pretty much a standard of care, and it's even advanced to the point where newer techniques are now showing how we can preserve the nerve supply to the skin envelope that we leave. And so it's these kinds of advancements that I've been very, very privileged to be involved
with. Amazing. I mean, you know, surgery these days is just the things that can be done. They're just absolutely mind-boggling, really. But very impressive.
I did all that, now it's gone on to robotic nipple-sparing mastectomy.
Yeah, I was going to say,
That's the next evolution. I'm not involved with that, but that helped get it at least to where we did, okay?
Yeah. Anyway, these things have, they make a big difference at the end of the day, of course, to the patient and what they have to live with afterwards. So it's, it's enormously important to people.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Enough of the prelims, we should get on to the main meat of today, which is exercise. Now, you've already said that there's, from a certain point of view, exercise seems to have crashed into the integrative oncology space quite quickly in recent years. But as you pointed out, there's actually a bit of a longer tail leading in there, a lot of background work being done in advance. What year did you say they were first studying it?
The very earliest trials that I could find was, I think, around 1989.
Right.
But it began in earnest in 1990. Earlier today, I was on a Zoom call with an exercise physiologist in Ulm, Germany, who was involved in 1990 with one of those very earliest clinical trials. I thought I was going to fall out of my chair when I met her. Isn't that? I keep talking about that beginning. She said, oh, yeah,
I was there. Right. Great. Yeah, so it has been going a while. And you also alluded to the massive mountain of evidence that's piled up now. Is the slightest reasonable grounds for being doubtful about the benefits of exercise now?
No. No, in fact, one of my recent essays was called Exercise Oncology. From proof to practice. What I did, there were, I think, about five papers publications last year and or editorials that all said, it's time to get going. We've got enough proof. We now need to move to practice. And I combined the thinking of those five publications into a single essay I'd be happy to share with you at some point. There was a real bellwether presentation last year that your audience needs to be aware of. The American Society of Clinical Oncology, or the initials are ASCO, or we all call it ASCO. The ASCO meeting in Chicago every June, Robin, is the largest meeting in the world that I am aware of medical oncologists, surgical oncologists, and radiation oncologists. And the presentation at the plenary session was on what was known as the Challenge Clinical Trial. Challenge Clinical Trial. It was first conceived of 20 years ago and then slowly put together. And the leaders for this were from Australia and Canada, particularly Western Canada. It also involves centers in Western Europe, some in the United States, etc. It was about colon cancer, what we call stage 2 high-risk colon cancer and stage 3 colon cancer. All the patients got the appropriate surgery. The high-risk stage 2 and 3s got adjuvant chemotherapy. And then there was nearly, I think, 450 in each group. I could be slightly off on those numbers, but we're a ballpark around 450. And they were randomized prospectively into two groups. A control group, where they were told live a healthy lifestyle, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the key, a structured exercise group.
Right.
And the first year of the structured exercise group was done on site at the medical centers that were involved with the trial. And the next 2 years were closely monitored, but the exercise programs that the patients had, they could do off-site. They weren't done on-site. The follow-up was, the median follow-up was nearly 8 years. And the numbers that came out of this ended up receiving a standing ovation at the ASCO meeting.
Right.
There was a 37% improved survival in the exercise group. And there was a 28% reduction in recurrence in the exercise group of either their original tumor, a separate, completely different tumor, or dying from other things called all-cause mortality.
Including that, right. Okay. That's a
yeah,
bonus.
They included, everything was closely, it was spectacular.
Yeah.
It was that same day published in the New England Journal Online, which is the leading, one of the leading research journals in the world, with an accompanying editorial that basically says, let's get going.
Mm.
Let's get this more into practice. Now, prior to that presentation, ASCO did have a guideline put out a few years ago recommending that patients be referred for exercise, those who are being treated for cure, meaning not stage 4 patients. And the recommendation was made to help mitigate the side effects of the treatment. Then we have what's called NCCN, National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which has an exercise recommendation, and they're a global organization. And that's that moderate intensity of 150 minutes a week, or a simple way of thinking about it is walking briskly for 30 minutes 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So you get your heart rate up to hopefully in the low 100s or higher. That gives you 150 minutes. And they want that then to be accompanied by at least 2 days a week of resistance training. That could be done with free weights at home, going to a gym, which many cancer survivors don't like doing,
right.
With resistance bands at home, things of that sort. So that standard has been out there in long-term survivorship. What we're hoping is that we can get NCCN to also support that exact same recommendation for patients in active treatment. And importantly, for your listeners, it's really important that they understand this is a continuum of care that starts at the time of diagnosis with what can be called prehabilitation, getting ready for the treatments, particularly during active treatment, and then subsequently into long-term survivorship. Or in other words, it's a lifetime journey. Okay?
Ryan. Amazing. Well, a spectacular result, as you say. I mean, if somebody stood up with a drug that did that, that you know, that would be like the whole place would fall over to get it, wouldn't they? But it's...
You know what? That's exactly what people have been saying. And interestingly, those numbers from the challenge trial actually beat out the known benefit of adjuvant chemotherapy.
Really? Right. Okay, amazing.
Yeah, and as we've all said, in fact, one of the editorials that I quoted in that essay was if exercise was a pill, we would all be taking it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thing about it is of course, there's, unlike the adjuvant chemotherapy, there's no downside to it.
Yep.
So same benefit, no downside. So fantastic. Yeah, well, you know, there we got. We got this on the one side. Okay, there's, you know, mountains of evidence, and that kind of evidence is just like, it's unbeatable. And yet, is everybody rushing to adopt this? Well, no. In fact, in the UK here, it's just like, you know, it's barely made a ripple yet. A few really advanced places are talking about exercise now, but across the country, no. It's not the sort of thing an oncologist would ever mention. You know, I know, I talk to patients, they don't get recommended to go and do some exercise. It takes 5 seconds to recommend to somebody that exercise will help them. They don't do it. And given that all of that is there, you'd think that we were kind of, you know, doing really well with cancer treatment. We don't need anything new, thanks very much. That's the kind of impression we get. Oh, we're all doing fine. Not that we're in an absolute catastrophe with the cancer figures rocketing all the time. And, you know, we're desperate for some new solutions. And there is one that's free, for God's sake. And it's not being picked up. So what's going on? Why not?
Well, it's the silo issue for a starter.
Mm-hmm.
A second one is that physicians are naturally conservative. Thirdly is the reimbursement or money issue. There's a lot more money in giving chemotherapy than there is recommending somebody go exercise. There's cultural issues. You know, change, Robin, comes in two directions. From the top down, meaning hardcore science, and from the bottom up, meaning patients demanding things. Okay.
Right.
We saw this most dramatically, at least in the States, when it came to what's called sentinel lymph node biopsy, which is selective biopsy in my world of breast cancer of the nodes, lymph nodes draining the breast. We barely had the science studies out when patients got a hold of this and said, wait a minute, you mean I don't have to have all my lymph nodes out of? And they started confronting their doctors.
Excellent.
And they said, well, Dr. Jones, do you know how to do this? That's a research guy. Oh, come on, Dr. Jones. I think it's beyond that. And so it ended up putting pressure on physicians to wake up, learn about science, and then actually take courses to learn how to do the technique, okay? So your broadcast can be part of that bottom-up phenomenon. Rob.
Yeah, I hope so.
And getting the other driving force here are the advocacy groups. You have breast advocacy groups in the UK. Yeah. We do in the United States. Once they got a hold of the sentinel node research, they were then bugging the doctors. Then the administrators at hospitals started hearing about this and knew there wasn't a big financial loss associated with it and said, tally ho, here we go, boys and girls, let's start doing this. So it's inherently a slow process. It is a evolutionary process, unfortunately, and not a revolutionary process. Mm. And I'd like to think that I know here in the U.S. that challenge clinical trial that we just talked about has really catapulted things forward.
How's that?
And we're hoping with when it comes to insurance coverage of exercise and oncology programs that we can make headway there. We've been working on this for the past 3 to 5 years or more, and especially at the federal level. We got real close in the last federal administration here under President Biden, and then everything blew up under the Trump administration. And I will say publicly, I don't want your listeners to think that the majority of Americans support Donald Trump. That's my... plug on that one now. We're horrified.
Okay.
And what's going on? And we're particularly horrified medically with cuts in research funding and and disease study funding and things of that sort. We're just horrified in this country about what's going on. But reality is that reimbursement can be a barrier as well.
Yes.
Your audience needs to know that this is very much like what we call cardiac rehab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was going to medical school and doing my surgery training, if somebody survived a heart attack, they were obviously they were told to go home and rest, you know, acutely. But then no one ever recommended exercised heart attack patients long term to try and prevent a future heart attack. Same thing was true with open heart surgery. You know, obviously you wanted to recover from the surgery, but nobody was out recommending to prevent whatever the bypass or other issue was that they needed to be exercising. That all changed years ago. And now after patients recover acutely, they are automatically referred to cardiac rehab programs to prevent further progression of their disease, et cetera. That is going to happen in cancer. The more integrated oncology programs we have, and that phenomena is growing, it is going to occur. But I'm hoping in the UK there that at least your advocacy groups and the folks listening to this broadcast will become vocal about this. Okay?
Yeah, I hope so too. That's what's needed. That's you're right. It's the only way it's going to happen here, that's for sure. It's a curious situation where, you know, we have this free at the point of delivery healthcare, which we like. From that point of view, you get knocked over by a bus, you get scraped up and put back together again quite efficiently. So that's very good. But on the other hand, though, it has this downside, which is like, the ability to be conservative is just extraordinary. And there's no competition, there's nobody else doing it other than paying for private healthcare. And they just are able to say, no, we don't do that. And that's the end.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
The station that makes you feel good.
Let me give you a word of hope here that I think is going to drive this. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
We have more and more what are called targeted immunotherapies being developed in the treatment of cancers.
Mm-hmm.
The classic example of that is malignant melanoma. Our own late President Jimmy Carter years ago, had widespread stage 4 malignant melanoma with including metastases to his brain. And President Carter received one of the early immunotherapies, which wiped out all of his residual disease. This is very, very similar to thinking back to the COVID pandemic when we used messenger RNA technology to help create vaccines, which were targeted against the specific targets of the spikes of the COVID viruses. Well, the same thing is starting to happen now in cancer. And what we're doing genomic profiling of individual tumors as they are biopsied, and then potentially figuring out how to create a vaccine against those specific tumors, or more generally, a targeted immunotherapy that covers several of the major genes of that tumor, and then creating targeted therapy. So more and more targeted immunotherapies are being developed. One of the things we know about exercise is that at the cellular molecular level, and this is what's being studied now, what is going on to give these improved clinical outcomes? And there are two things going on. One is every time we moderately exercise, our muscles are releasing things called myokines, M-Y-O-K-I-N-E-S, okay, myokines. These are polypeptides and proteins that circulate around the body. They have an anti-inflammatory effect, and in certain tumors have a direct anti-tumor growth effect. We know that to be true in cultures of prostate cancer cells, as an example, where you add the serum of exercising people, and it slowed men, and it slows down the growth of the cancer cells. And there are other benefits, therefore, of enhancing, obviously, cardiovascular system, central nervous system, et cetera. The second thing that's going on that's really critical is that every time we moderately exercise, we are boosting the immune system. The immune system is releasing more killer lymphocytes, T helper cells, macrophages, and other products. And so one of the research efforts that's just starting now is what if we exercise folks prior to receiving the immunotherapy? Is it going to make the immunotherapies more effective? And that's a real hope that now finally all these things get combined together. And if that, those clinical trials prove that to be the case, and some of the preliminary results are that is going to be the case, then the medical oncologists who are going to be giving the immunotherapies won't really have a choice, Robin. They're going to have to.
I can see that. Yeah. No, that'll be a great accelerator. I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a bit like it's happened in the research around the microbiome. You know, when it began.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. That could actually accelerate and improve. Drug treatment, you know, is like, okay, we better look at this. And so, yeah, I think you're right there. Thank you for the hopeful word there.
Well, and you mentioned microbiome. There is plenty of research that shows that exercise actually improves the gut biome, okay?
Yeah.
So that's another one of the benefits of the circulating myokines and the other things that are going on.
There are so many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, look, literally, yeah. We need to remember exercise is literally medicine.
Agreed. Thank you. That's the message. So you talked earlier on about these two directions in which change can come, top down, bottom up, and they're both important, of course. And, you know, you spent your lifetime being a top down man. You've been pushing forward the boundaries of surgery with everything you've done. But if I'm not mistaken, you've kind of defected now to be a bit of a bottom-up man. You are now working to get the word out widely in the way that I do to people so that they go and they start demanding things from their oncologists. Am I right?
You are, sir. That's why I started cancerfitness.org about 18 months ago. I was so shocked at the lack of knowledge of at least 85% of my own colleagues, surgeons, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists. I was determined to create an educational website. I don't sell anything. I don't promote anything at cancerfitness.org. It's not only an educational website for my colleagues, but also for newly diagnosed cancer patients, their family members, and others. I have also developed an email list at cancerfitness.org. You're on it. I just hit 560 people on that email list in 28 countries. I try and put out 3, sometimes 4 times a month, the latest publications that I can find on the benefits of exercise for cancer patients and share it with my group. Many people have asked me, GJ, where are you going with this? And I said, you know, I think we're building the airplane as we're flying it. I'm not quite sure where this is ultimately going to end up, but we're getting more and more traction. And also, as you know, Robin, I post very regularly on LinkedIn. That's another very effective way of trying to reach my medical colleagues, hopefully healthcare administrators and people of that sort. I try and post, if I can, at least 3 times a week on LinkedIn as well.
Mm. Very good. Well, you know, I think the grassroots approach is imperative because if we're in the midst of a war on cancer, from my point of view, cancer is winning hands down. You know, the numbers are just rocketing up ever higher. And we need the top-down approach. Yeah, okay, it makes some good progress. You yourself have made some good progress, but it's too slow at this point. It's just too slow. And, you know, what we've got is patients out there doing it themselves, basically, you know, whether it's repurposed drugs, fasting, ketogenics, oxygen therapies, metabolic approaches, psychological and emotional care, you know, even cancer theory. So basically, patients are out there exploring the world of cancer, sharing information for themselves. And it's a bit of a wild west, for sure. That's the kind of downside of the whole thing. But it's also quite extraordinary what's happening, I find. I mean, from my perspective, watching people, the ones who get educated and take a pragmatic approach and talk to everybody and listen to everything, but, you know, they're serious about wanting to stay alive, they extend their lives enormously beyond any expectations of oncology. And that's just being savvy, basically. So that pool of knowledge needs to become mainstream as quickly as possible. We all need it. And so I'm pleased that this is happening overall. What's going to happen in the end, I don't know. You know, the resistance to change has got to sort of, has got to be a dam bust sometime. We can't keep it up forever. And we have to keep pushing, I think, because I want to see all these changes, including exercise, almost first and foremost. That's one of the biggest wins we could have, just like that, and it's free. You know, it's just extraordinary that it's sitting there waiting to be picked as a solution for people, and it's not really being picked, certainly not in this country. So,
well, one of the other groups that we're trying to focus on is the fitness industry.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know the size of the fitness industry in the UK, but it's
substantial. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big business here in the United States. So there are national and international organizations of fitness centers, of course. Here in the United States, our YMCAs have a program called Live Strong. Not unfortunately. It was named after Lance Armstrong, of course, originally.
Yeah.
So he bit the dust, but they're still very, very active with the Live Strong. These are called Cancer Fit programs offered at the YMCAs.
It's good.
There are trainers under Cancer Fit. One of the groups I'm involved with, Maple Tree Cancer Alliance, has a certification process for the Live Strong trainers, so they're just not anybody off the street trying to help cancer patients.
Right, right, right.
And so there's another pressure point. And in my view, and I think the view of others, we need to get the fitness industries globally really interested in chronic disease management, of which cancer is a chronic disease. It is a lifelong journey for so many people.
Yes.
Let alone type 2 diabetes, let alone obesity.
As, I was just like, yeah, that ASCO thing with it actually stopped people from dying from all causes. That's the whole point of exercise. It's just good for you.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because actually the leading killer of cancer patients is not their cancer.
Right.
The leading killer of cancer patients is actually cardiovascular disease.
Is that right?
Or the ravages of the other diseases they have, such as diabetes, et cetera.
Yeah.
I was about to say the World Health Organization has predicted a significant increase in the incidence of cancer globally.
Yeah.
And when we look at why that's the case, well, I think the world's population in general is getting older. The world's population is more sedentary. The world's population is more obese. The world's population is consuming more processed food. The world's population is becoming isolated. We don't have strong social bonds, et cetera, et cetera. Or in other words, it's ultimately all about lifestyle.
Right with you there.
And it's estimated that between 35 to 40% of cancers are preventable by appropriate lifestyle measures, of which exercise and diet are obviously.
And I'd say that's probably very conservative. And we're out of time. What a great chat, Jay. Thank you very much indeed. It's a real privilege to talk to people like you who are kind of got this immense medical background, but you're down here in the grassroots with all our sort shouting out, come on, let's have some change. It's very heartening to hear. So thank you very much.
Well, it's absolutely been my privilege, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you're listening to this, then you're probably a signed-up member of the grassroots movement we've been talking about today. If so, I urge you to take some of the extraordinary facts that Dr. Harness has been sharing about the effectiveness of exercise as medicine for cancer to your oncologist and find out what they know about it and what they think about it. And if they've never spoken to you about exercise, then see if you can get them to start. Encourage them to look at those trial results presented at ASCO. Let them know just how important this is to their patients. It's only about 5 weeks now to the first of our two 2026 conferences, the online conference on the 16th of May. The title is Reclaiming Our True Nature, and it features a jam-packed schedule of inspiring speakers, all addressing the question of what science is telling us about the impact of psychological, emotional, and spiritual factors on survivorship. Find out more and book your place at conference.yestolife.org.uk. And while you're there, you can also find out details of the in-person conference with the same title that'll be on the 26th of September in London. If you're able to attend both, then you can get yourself tickets to both while you're there. Thanks so much for listening today. I'd love to have you join me again next week at the same time for the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. So do please make a note. Goodbye.